Welcome to the My Data Podcast. I'm your host, Molly Schwartz. I'm a My Data founder and convener of the New York City My Data Hub. And right now we're recording inside the Metropolitan New York Library Council studio, so thanks to them. My Data is a vision, and it's a set of principles, and it's a movement, and it's also a conference. And our objective is to develop awareness of how we as individuals can have more control over the data that describes us and also the data trails that we're leaving behind us in our everyday life. And you can find more information about this at the website, mydata.org, and more information about the conference at mydata2018.org. In every episode of the My Data Podcast, we talk to a guest about their experience with personal data and privacy. But before we get into our guest today, this is My Data Minute.
Hi, I'm Vivi Lahtenoya, Project Manager for My Data 2018 conference. This is My Data Minute. Welcome. In June, we celebrated Pride Month all over the globe, and I wanted to share some thoughts about how my data is relevant for Pride. So what happens in your bedroom is your data, and June celebrates your right to be as public or as private about that information as you like. Pride is a celebration of the diversity of human experience and the diversity of human love. How we identify as human beings and whom we love are deeply, deeply personal issues. And so deciding with whom we share these aspects of our existence and how must be our own choice and no one else's. In Finland, where I am, sharing this personal data is, for the most part, safe. But of course, this is not the case everywhere in the world. My data works towards a world where digital human rights, like privacy and expression, as chosen by the individual, are respected globally. We believe that a future in which your activities in and out of the bedroom are yours to share or to protect, that future can become a reality now, as long as we work together. But now, enjoy the interview portion of this episode of the My Data Podcast. Take it away, Molly.
Our guest today is Dr. Adrian Grapper. Adrian is the CTO of the Patient Privacy Rights Nonprofit, and he's done a lot of work in the physician-patient relationship, and he's worked as an engineer in the past developing medical devices. And we're really excited to have him on the podcast today. How are you doing, Adrian?
Excellent. Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about patient privacy rights. How did you become involved in this work?
Sure. Patient privacy rights was founded about 11 or 12 years ago by a psychiatrist named Deborah Peel. She was also a Freudian analyst. She was well along her career. And as computers started coming in, she noticed that patients were coming to her asking if she would be their physician as long as she would not use the computer to take notes, because they were worried about the privacy of their conversations. And she started looking around at the policies and what was happening with HIPAA, which is the data privacy law in the United States, and ended up starting this nonprofit, Patient Privacy Rights, to sort of promote this, the interest of the physician-patient relationship. So it's not strictly a physician-oriented mission or a patient-oriented mission. It is all about that relationship between, say, the psychiatrist or the therapist and the patient. I came along about 5.5, 6 years ago now. My career started out, my entire career after engineering and medical school has been as an entrepreneur in medical devices, all of them with a very large computer content, software, and sometimes even hardware content early on. And my last startup started about 10 or so years ago, failed miserably on account of the way how sophisticated the people that could control data were getting at doing things that we now recognize as, for instance, the Cambridge Analytical scandal with Facebook and many other similar things. The method of surveillance capitalism was young, 10 years ago. And we can talk a little more about that if we want. But so my startup in health records development failed, and I was sort of left without either constituency, because an entrepreneur with neither money nor product to develop. And so I became the chief technology officer of Patient Privacy Rights, complementing her the original mission by being able to participate in movements like My Data in a technical sense, as well as the sort of people sense.
So tell me a little bit about what it was like 10 years ago with the start of surveillance capitalism. How did that affect your ability to develop technologies that would give people more access to their health records?
It's a little bit of a complicated story, and it might get very boring. So because it involves something about standards. It involves how companies control regulation as they get bigger, or come to be beyond regulation when they get really, really big. And this is all about technology. And remember, I'm genetically an engineer. My medical practice ended after internship. And so I see everything through the eyes of technology and a problem that an engineer might be able to solve. What happened to my most successful business was we benefited from standards greatly. In other words, the standards, in this case, DICOM, which are used in radiology imaging around the world, enabled new companies like mine to come into a business that was otherwise dominated by large hardware manufacturers like Philips, GE, Siemens, the ones that make the big scanners. And yet we were able to introduce software into that business, advanced software and networking functions, because the standards worked. And this was maybe 20 years ago, let's say. The internet was young, but it had been established, and I was able to start a very successful business around internet standards in radiology, for health records, obviously, again. What happened 10 years ago was a very big surprise to me. The large incumbent industrial interests had gotten so sophisticated at manipulating the standards and the policies around the standards and the way technology was being used, especially computing technology, that they no longer were susceptible to another startup like mine that was going to do something to empower individuals and doctors in this in their relationship. And I basically got shut out. And it wasn't just me that got shut out. It was anybody trying to innovate. So Microsoft, for example, and Google also entered this marketplace around that time, a few years after I did. And Google got out. Google Health was the health record. Google got out of the business within about a year and a half. Microsoft stayed in for about 5 or 6 years and spent what some people say on the inside was $1 billion trying to do, again, this kind of patient-centered, person-centered, personal health records, whatever you want to call it, smack in the middle of what My Data is about. And after 6 years, they actually shut that down. It was called Health Vault as well. And the thing that characterizes this failed business of mine, the Google failure and the Microsoft failure, is that nothing comes of it. At the end of $1 billion or 7 or 8 years, whether it's a startup like mine or Microsoft's effort, you can look around and you see nothing. You don't see a trademark. You don't see a piece of software that somebody's using. You don't see a remnant or a spin-off business where you say, oh, that merged into this other thing. And so these last 10 or so years where we saw this combination of the perfection of surveillance capitalism and this concentration of power that then goes beyond the standards to actually become oligopolies or monopolies around personal information, this is all very new. And it is all still ongoing. And it is why I joined patient privacy rights, because then I, in that way, I gained the constituency to participate in the policies and standards and bring my engineering expertise to a domain where engineers tend to work for very, very large companies with very large vested interests.
So if companies like Google and Microsoft were getting shut out of the market because there were these proprietary standards that people were using, who were the big companies that were shutting everybody out?
The big companies were integrated delivery networks, were very large hospital systems. And this has nothing to do with technology directly, but it completely impacted technology. In the United States, about 30 years ago, people started talking in terms of something called managed care. Before managed care, the relationship between physicians, hospitals, and doctors had been sort of the same since, you know, long before computers and long before sort of industrialized medicine. People in Europe might not relate to this as much because in Europe, care has been managed maybe for as far back as they can remember. But in the United States, physicians tended to be more independent and to actually run the hospitals. And so what happened was that over the space of about 30 years, this tendency in the United States, which is very privatized and mistrusts government interference, this caused a lot of concentration of power in the hospitals that were affiliated with academic institutions or with unions. In other words, hospitals that had a natural size, whether they, even though, you know, their mission was nonprofit or driven by, you know, workers' unions in the West Coast with Kaiser, you know, what started out, they became incredibly powerful as healthcare became industrialized in the United States. And they could now dictate the standards and the technology that would allow them to grow even more powerful. In other words, to put out of business smaller hospitals or independent physician practices and bring them into sort of the umbrella of the managed organization. In the case of these health records projects that I mentioned, it didn't really matter how big the engineering company was, Microsoft, Google, my tiny startup. What mattered was that over 30 years, these hospitals became very powerful at doing local politics at the city level, at the county level, at the state level, and at the federal level. And they came to dominate anything having to be able to sort of build the technology to support their local dominance in terms of negotiating with insurance companies and all sorts of strange stuff that, again, only people in the U.S. can experience. What actually happened was that health information technology moved into the domain of a couple of startups, very large startups, that just learned how to cater to these very large hospital systems. Epic was the first one. They came to be known because they started working with Kaiser, which was this, again, very interesting managed care operation in the West Coast. And then Cerner came along and so there was a lot of acquisition, a lot of internal development, but pretty much the information technology industry became captured by the very large academic or just very large integrated delivery networks, as we call them.
So if now we see physicians that are working for these massive institutions like certain hospitals, and that was kind of a shift in a concentration of power and they had their own proprietary technology systems, how would things look different if physicians were more beholden to their patients, and how could technology help facilitate that shift?
You just have to remember back to before we had computers and networks. In those days, the relationship between the physician and the patient did not involve any institution whatsoever. It did not involve a hospital necessarily. It did not involve an employer, even if the physician was practicing in a hospital or employed by a different group. The relationship between the physician and the patient was not mediated because the medium of record keeping was paper. And the paper was managed either by the patient or by the physician, typically by the physician. In the military, the paper was managed by the soldier themselves as they moved around. in no way was there a mediator, technological or institutional, in between what the physician and the patient did. Only what got written on paper was recorded and signed and moved on to the next relationship. What happened as we introduced computers and networking in a big way in healthcare over, you know, the last decade plus, the institutions, because they were so powerful and so well organized, in the US, the rate of administrators grew at about 3x the rate at which nurses and social workers and doctors would be added to these institutions. So they became very expert at corporate behavior, not just in the political scene, not just in the standard scene, but also in the way they would manage quality, for example, in the healthcare enterprise. And this definitely has a good side to it. You know, you reduce quackery, you reduce the risk of having bad apple physicians do very bad things. So it's not necessarily a bad thing to industrialize the relationship. But what it also does is it introduces this mediator that now is no longer controlled by either the patient or the physician. And this mediation of the relationship by computers and institutions is what Deborah Peel, what the founder of PPR, originally noticed and said, what can we do about this?
And so what are you doing about it? What kind of technology are you building?
Let me introduce one other very important concept as, or that's not even a concept, it's obvious when you think about it. Up until now being the 21st century and, you know, 2018, up until now, all of the technology had to be controlled by institutions. So when you look at health records or personal data in general, not just health records, and you say, where was the computer technology that we all sort of grew up with over, say, 40 years? Where was it concentrated? Well, it was either the domain of a government, right? The government had computers, databases. It was the domain of large institutions. You know, hospitals could add computers and, like I say, create these winners in computer companies that became large to serve their interests. And it became the domain of corporations. Corporations like IBM or Google or Facebook could own technology for managing personal data and allow people, allow is the operative word here, you're their calf, if you would, you're their child, their client, and allow corporations to use that technology. And this is held true pretty much through past the beginning of the century. But what happens is that as we entered the age of big data, people starting to realize that data was worth more when it's collected in one place. As people realize that you could start to profile individuals like Facebook does and collect data longitudinally and across their different relationships. So people like Facebook and Google figured out how to offer a whole range of computer services, that email, search, document management, document processing, et cetera. Facebook figured out how to put like buttons on things that you buy and things that you do that have nothing to do with Facebook directly. Two things happened. Sort of the surveillance capitalism caused the aggregation of data in the form of the big data movement and in this form of sort of broad aggregation. At the same time, as the cost of technology, what we call Moore's Law, maybe we still, keeps going down and down and down. So the data gets more valuable as it's aggregated, and the cost of technology itself that used to be the domain of Google and the local hospital chain and the government keeps going down at both of them at a very fast rate. Well, eventually these two trends are going to cross over. In other words, the cost of the technology of that computer that was being given to you by others, whether they're good governments, good corporations or bad corporations, good hospitals or bad hospitals, it's theirs, it's not your technology. That crosses over with the value of your data, my data. At that point, you can now own the technology completely. You no longer are the child, the client, the serf of somebody that is giving you access to technology out of the goodness of their heart, but you now own your technology, maybe the way you own your car, and you know that you own something if you can change it, if you can teach it, if you can resell it to somebody else without anybody interfering with you. You own something if you have gold, for example, and you could take it somewhere else and nobody can stop you, and it's, and so on. Or you can own knowledge that you can teach in the open source software sense. And again, no jurisdiction or institution. And one other very important piece of technology which comes in at this point, in this sense of owning technology that is self-sovereign, is the introduction of Bitcoin and blockchain methods. Because what they sort of, what the Bitcoin in 2009 and then Ethereum a few years later and all of these public blockchains introduced, is they taught the world that not only could you own technology in the sense of mining Bitcoin in the early days on your own computer that you owned, but you could have that technology exist, owned, be owned by you as in an individual doctor or patient outside any jurisdictional or institutional constraint, which never happened before. So now, as we've had, say, 8 or 9 years of rapid economic development, where people have sort of begun to pay a lot of attention to this $200-300 billion worth of blockchain economy that we already have, and it grew up so rapidly over these last 10 years again that we're talking about, people sort of realized that now they had a new kind of independence, a new kind of ownership that was no longer jurisdictional, like that hospital record or that state-controlled health record or that Google-controlled health record, that bank, big bank record, again, because they control the technology, but you were also independent of the rules that would be made by somebody else in the jurisdictional or the corporate policy sense. And so now you not only had that drop in the technology cost that allowed you to be a miner, but you had proof at a very large economic scale that owned technology could work. It was no longer a fringe. You know, open source was now the core of how this technology was deployed. Nobody would dream of a blockchain that wasn't completely open source. The transparency into how it's used, the fact that all these groups would put up white papers, and first of all, they would be totally open about how this thing worked. So it went beyond open source, and also just a very different method around intellectual property, which we're not going to get into, it's getting esoteric. But anyway, so the bottom line is that what I started to work on many years ago was this merger of this realization that individuals could own technology, be they the doctor or the patient, they could each have their own technology again, just like in the days of paper. But also this realization that we now had a way of decentralizing governance. Anyway, so the bottom line is that what I started to work on many years ago was this merger of this realization that individuals could own technology, be they the doctor or the patient, they could each have their own technology again, just like in the days of paper, but also this realization that we now had a way of decentralizing governance. And that lesson was brought in from the blockchain, the public blockchain world.
And so in terms of delegating control, I've thought of it in terms of consent. I guess delegation is a similar concept, that you have something that's acting on your behalf to that you have already defined what you consent to it sharing with these other authorized services. The authorized services that you can have acting on your behalf instead of having your own personal data store, for this to work, do those have to be open source?
No, but the authorization server has to be open source. In other words, your robot, the thing right. that has a fiduciary relationship to you, whether it's in the software agent sense or in the robot sense, that has to be open source, because if it's not open source and it is not standards-based, so it doesn't only have to be open source, it also has to be standards-based. And I'll give you a very good example. Apple is a superbly privacy-preserving enterprise. They compete on that basis to an extent that almost nobody else does. Again, Mozilla with Firefox also tries to compete on privacy, and I defy you to come up with a third well-known name of somebody in the information business that's competing on privacy today. And so, but when you look at Apple, it's a walled garden. And the reason it's a walled garden is because they're not using standards. So they're being open in saying Apple will not see your data, therefore we can't sell it, we can't use it because we don't even see it. And it's a very simple privacy policy. But, and they may be using open source software to manage your data. Certainly, you know, a lot of the research kit apps and things like that, you know, are open source. But to the extent that it is not standards-based, you cannot necessarily substitute an Android piece of hardware for an Apple piece of hardware. You are locked in. When we talk about being self-sovereign as a technology stack in this HIE of One project, when we talk about being self-sovereign identity in the standards that I talked about in the Rebooting Web of Trust, we not only insist on it being open source, but we insist on it being substitutable or standards-based, so that you're not locked into the governance of the Bitcoin blockchain, for example, because all of the identity is based on Bitcoin. In order to actually have this decentralized and person-centered and yet the ability to coalesce into governance groups, you have to make sure that the substitutability and therefore the standards that are important to choosing your governance method have to be in place as well. So you have to go beyond open source.
Yeah, and getting into standards is hugely important. I think this concept that you're talking about in terms of substitutability, in terms of my data in the past, I think we've used the word interoperability a lot. And you were also speaking to the idea of being able to switch from one thing to another. If you have the same road that goes from one thing to another, you can simply take the road to any number of places. I know that with the European General Data Protection Regulations, a big article in that that a lot of people are talking about is this concept of data portability. And so I want to get into your ideas about GDPR and this idea of data portability and what you think of what's come out of the data regulations in Europe.
The data regulations in Europe are good, but they have quite a ways to go. They are definitely a step in the right direction. It's well thought out. It is a huge progress, and it is certainly the state of the art in terms of privacy regulations. But it is not nearly enough. And the reason has to do with the issue of consent that you raised a little earlier versus authorization. Consent is a very difficult thing for people to manage. They are manipulated. They are not interested. Some combination of, or they're not educated enough to exercise informed consent. It's always a combination of all three. You cannot stop with consent. You have to go to transparency and then to authorization in order to achieve the goals that I think GDPR is definitely trying to achieve. And GDPR, as it stands, has not actually increased transparency and authorization to in the sense of interoperability or in any other sense enough to sort of say, okay, now we know how to build stuff. Portability that's built into GDPR is way too high a barrier for people to shift congregations, to shift churches, for it to be a practical effect. And the consent pieces of GDPR are way too abstract for people to not be manipulated, not be confused, or not be bothered. So you have these two problems in how GDPR is structured and how GDPR is going to be enforced. And again, let me repeat, it is the state of the art. It is not, I'm not saying go back or start over. I'm just pointing out that it's only a third of the way there. Telling people to take all of your data and move it elsewhere is kind of akin to, for instance, what we experience when we decide to switch credit cards or to switch banks. Yeah, you could take your money, and now you're left with reestablishing all of those relationships that you had with the auto pay accounts and the credit cards. And people don't do that more than once every couple of years. You got to really be pissed off at your bank before you will do that. Data portability in the GDPR sense mirrors that kind of take it or leave it situation. You don't want to have take it or leave it situations. You want to have incremental shifts that cost you nothing, or you want to have standards that allow you to move not just your money, but also all the relationships. And to some extent, you know, the Payment Service Directive 2, PSD2, is trying to now implement that, you know, in parallel with GDPR, right? So when you have something like PSD2, which is, again, has many flaws in the delegation sense, that we would like to see much more powerful standards for delegation. That's what than what's in PSD2 as it's being implemented today. But again, it's a very nice step in terms of standards, because now with PSD2, you're actually managing delegation or authorization for payment processing. So you no longer have to move your money from bank A to bank B wholesale the way you used to with the credit card as the payment processor. You could move it incrementally, one business or one subset of commerce at a time, and that's a lot less painful.
I like this analogy with the bank, because on one hand, you have your bank and you have your established credit card, and I think some things that people have seen as the next step with data portability is like moving your money, but it's also moving all of your records. Like you can download all of your transaction history or something like that in machine readable format. And you're saying that the next level would be that you would be able to seamlessly reestablish all of your relationships, your pre-existing relationships with one credit card, even you could switch services. And by having this kind of delegation system, it would like automatically reestablish those relationships with a new bank.
Yes. But I also want to point out something that you sort of glossed over very quickly in that last statement, which is hugely important. When you said all of your records, as we are in this new world, right, where there's unlimited networking, unlimited computing capacity, unlimited ability for, say, governments to surveil everything about you everywhere, we have to start paying a lot of attention to who is aggregating information about us. To the extent that we allow either governments or businesses, whether they're banks or Facebook or Google, to start aggregating information, to create files on us the way our telephone companies are doing now, we have to be very, very careful, because we as individuals are losing leverage over these massive institutions that are not easy to govern and easy to control. We don't want to be putting in systems that allow these banks to create the dossiers, the records that you mentioned in the first place. Even if they're benevolent in how they manage consent, even if we improve the ability to express our consent and educate the population around consent, which is impossible, we still should not be building these bundles of policies about us that other people have. We have to keep these policies very close to home, inside our heads, inside maybe our close families and friends. We do not want people bundling our identity routinely, regardless of how nice they are in terms of standards and in terms of informing us of what they do. It's just bad practice. Interoperability doesn't mean ask me all of my preferences, ask me all of my deepest secrets, and I promise that they'll be interoperable and that I'll hold them secure. That's an unnecessary risk. You can own the technology to keep those to yourself, and only let people know what decisions you make as a result of your policies, but not what your actual policies are.
When you were talking about your work on HIE of One, or Health Information Exchange of One, you were mentioning this identity piece and the concept of keeping the ability to be able to keep your identity kind of distributed in a way. If you look at how some things are evolving in especially European countries with health records, they have much more centralized identity systems. Do you see those working well, or do you think it's problematic that these identity systems are centralized?
It's hugely problematic. The reason is that it's impossible to govern things related to healthcare at the level of entire populations. At some point, you end up literally farming the population. You end up really saying, you know, you end up picking winners and losers in a way that governments should not be doing or not well positioned to doing. When you aggregate information because the citizens trust you, which they do, and because you've done a pretty good job, at least compared to the US and other rich nations, which they have, you then get to a point with respect to health records explicitly, where you now have to make all of the policies. And it becomes a political process. And you sort of see in the UK versus France versus Germany versus Israel, all of these countries that have done a very good job of managing, aggregating and managing records, and they have strong benefits, are now chafing at the politics of making policies on a national scale. That is, I would claim, an unnecessary in this day and age. We want to promote diversity. We want to promote mobility across state borders. Introducing the government of a particular country and its political system as a way of managing what's research, what's not. And there's lots written about this, particularly as it impacts corporate AI, like Italy selling 61 million records or giving 61 million records to IBM, or the UK and London giving a couple of million records to Google DeepMind for their AI projects. And you get into these situations as a country where making the decisions as to how to monetize this data that you own, and because you're monetizing it in different ways, becomes impossible. I mean, it's not impossible, but it becomes difficult to manage at scale. And so I don't think any kind of centralization, whether it's at the level of Google or at the level of a country or at the level of a massive hospital system in the US or in India that you might create, none of this sort of very centralized information governance should be applied to entire populations.
In terms of centralizing data, I want to get a bit into concepts of privacy and security. I know that you get frustrated that the concepts of privacy and security are so often conflated. Tell me about why they are different and why you think people do conflate them.
The best definition of privacy versus security comes out of this U.S. government institution called NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology. And so I love the work they do in general, and they define security as information security breaches, as things that happen that are exceptional. They're either due to hackers or to a bug in the code. They are a fault. There's something was misdesigned or misused or illegally used when you have a security breach. They define privacy as a harm or a breach or a problem that when the system is working as designed, you know, you're getting exactly the response from the technology that you've engineered or from the system that you've engineered, that you designed it for, and yet it is causing harm or is causing damage to society or to an individual. The reason I get frustrated when people introduce security into conversations about privacy is because what they're doing is avoiding the problem of design, of privacy engineering, of engineering, of how are you going to design a better system, which is what I try to do, and instead shifting to this motherhood and apple pie situation. Well, of course, everybody wants to get the bugs out of the system. Of course, everybody wants to keep the hackers. And, you know, nobody's going to argue with that. In the case of healthcare, the result is very, very harmful, because you could have a country with all of the healthcare issues that we have in the United States, where we're spending almost a half again as much as, say, other rich countries on healthcare, and yet we have these huge disparities between different groups of people. And, you know, just we even have huge disparities in how long people live in this country from one zip code to the next. And so we have these huge problems, but instead of dealing with the problems and trying to engineer around the problems, we're talking about security issues. And I tell people, imagine that you have fixed 100% of all of the security problems that you've had in the last 5 years in healthcare. They're all gone. All the hacks, all the whatever, all the bugs. Would any of the real problems that we have in terms of cost and disparities and unfairness be any different if we had fixed all of those security problems? And the answer is clearly no. They would all still be in place. A few people that were adversely affected by snooping on their records or by, you know, some unfair treatment here and there, but society as a whole and the health system as a whole would be exactly where we are today, even if none of those things had happened. That's why I'm so passionate about not sucking the air out of the room by introducing security considerations, when what we really should be talking about from a governance perspective is the policy issues, the privacy issues.
So providing good security is making sure that the system doesn't break, but privacy is how the system was designed to work. So if people don't start caring about privacy and how the system works, then they'll never solve the issues with privacy. Let's talk a little bit about why surveillance is an issue and why you are saying that people should not have their personal data bundled in any one source in the first place. How do you talk to younger generations about concepts like privacy, people who've grown up in a surveillance system, essentially? Do they see that it's a problem? And if not, why not?
The little that I do talk to young people, and I'd certainly like to do a lot more, I try to approach them from the perspective of the gig economy and reputation, because they do understand that they are now involved in career choices that don't necessarily involve working your entire life or for one or two corporations the way maybe their parents or their parents' parents used to. Young people take for granted that they're going to be a lot more mobile, that they might go to work for a corporation, but they're not going to be there through retirement. That they might even want to go and participate in the gig economy, in the online services or the distributed services business. And therefore, they're going to have to manage reputation, their reputation in the context of their work and in the context of how they make a living very, very carefully. By introducing the gig economy as a principle, or the ability to be mobile in who, what kind of institutions you work with and what your ability is to get a job at those institutions, you now have a way of reaching people at early in their careers while they are still working on their credentials, you know, their degrees and their licenses, and also having to very much consider what kind of information trail they're leaving in Facebook, in Twitter, in LinkedIn, anywhere where they are leaving this digital exhaust, as we call it, that people are now storing forever and indexing very effectively.
Yeah, I could see that would definitely be deterring to a young person if you're just getting started on your life, in your life, that there'd be these mechanisms that are kind of beyond your control that would be controlling what you can do with your future. I'm wondering, what are you hoping to hear about at the My Data Conference? What are you looking forward to?
I'm very interested in the interoperability and the standards track. You know, obviously, I've been involved with various groups that are involved in the MyData. I haven't participated in the MyData conference myself, but I'm well aware of the personal data movement and the technology. And I also participate in various groups that are starting to deal with artificial intelligence and autonomous systems. And, you know, the IEEE project that's trying to develop some, not quite standards yet, but that's coming, but at least policies and language around dealing with AI and autonomous systems. So I am involved in, you know, a handful of groups that are dealing with pieces of what's going on at MyData. And my particular focus is the fact that most of these groups have not moved to understand standards and interoperability in a sophisticated enough way, in a way that sort of starts to introduce how do we work towards decentralized information governance? How do we work towards substitutability and portability? So I'm seeing that MyData, certainly, you know, with the way the program is being done, and the fact that, you know, I was invited, we're starting to pay a lot more attention to that. And so I think there's a maturation of the MyData movement and also the hubs themselves. So, for example, some of us that are physicians are trying to figure out, well, should we now start to have a hub that's oriented to physicians rather than to a particular geographic location like New York that you're involved with?
That would be really interesting to start getting some thematic MyData hubs. I'd be curious to see what happens. And where can people find information about you and your work on HIE of One or patient privacy rights?
Well, it's easy enough to go to hieofone.org and patientprivacyrights.org also has. We are not a very well-funded nonprofit. As a matter of fact, we're a very small nonprofit. So the website is, and also HIE of One, it's more a bunch of code on GitHub than it is a public relations effort. We'd like to fix that. But we can't do everything immediately. There's also a blog role. My personal website, it does have an up-to-date list of the things that I blog about as one of the top-level links, and that's healthurl.com.
And is the blog role like where you've been blogging for different platforms, different places?
When journalists do an article, or when there's a recording of a session where I have a major component, I'll put it there as well.
I feel like we touched upon a lot of pretty meaty topics, so I want to give people places they can go if they really want to dig into it. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. This was really interesting and has just made me excited about what we're going to talk about in August.
My pleasure. You're a great interviewer. I appreciate the prep and the focus. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the MyData podcast. The MyData conference takes place in Helsinki, Finland, August 29th to 31st, 2018. Find out more on this year's conference website at mydata2018.org. The show notes and video versions of this podcast are available on the MyData Global Network website at mydata.org. You can contact us via email at podcast@mydata.org or on Twitter @mydataorg. We thank the Metropolitan New York Library Council for letting us record in their studio at 599 11th Avenue in New York City. Music is by David Cutter Music and Joachim Karud. This podcast is copyright MyData 2018. The MyData podcast was produced by me, Gianfranco Cicconi. The host was Molly Schwartz. Video and audio are available for redistribution under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License version 4.0 International. See you next time.